The following episode of Faux Hop is rated MA. It contains alternating hosts, a rotating roster of guests, and mild coarse language. Faux Hop advises that it is not suitable for anyone under the age of 15, or anyone who came here looking for one of those highbrow NPR-type podcasts. Minors must be accompanied by a parent or guardian. This is John Deek speaking.
Hello and welcome to Faux Hop. My name is Charlie Clawson and my guest, well, it seems kind of redundant to introduce because if you've had a TV in the last 20 years or a radio or you listen to podcasts, you know who Osher Ginsberg is. He's the host of The Masked Singer. He's the host of The Bachelor. He was the host of Australian Idol. He had a documentary come out on SBS called A Matter of Life and Death. And he did a podcast called Dad Pod with some guy who was his dead weight, who he carried through like the professional he is. Osher, is this your first Faux Fop? I know you've done a philosophy.
I've been on Faux Fop so rarely, it's a number of zero. Yeah.
Oh,
so,
right. But okay.
I'm thrilled to be in the alumni that have been on this show. It's you know, I guess I can, you know, just call up Dave Anthony and say, hey, mate, so we're literally best friends now. So,
yeah. we call it Osh Fop. I mean, I kind of feel like you're slumming it with the, you know, the prestige with the projects that you're working on now.
I can't believe I don't know what the F of Faux Fop means.
Well, it's a good question, Osh, because what does Faux Fop really mean anyway? Like the name has evolved and morphed and become its own thing. Will came up with Faux Fop. I believe the idea. I think Dave Anthony, funnily enough, is the one who came up with it, because when I left to do Home and Away and Will carried on doing Faux Fop but with guests, I don't think he'd renamed it at that point. And then, and look, I might be making this up, but my understanding is that Dave Anthony said, well, Faux Fop is a ridiculous name. You should just call it Faux Fop. And then that extended to, well, it's kind of not quite Faux Fop, so it's a Faux Fop.
Ah, the F-A-U-X.
Yes, but I don't know if that was intentional or if that was retrofitted to it. And then there's
another school of thought
that 30-odd foot of pod, half of 30-odd foot of pod is 15-odd foot of pod, so it would make it Faux Fop. So,
that's too nerdy. Your listeners would come up with something as mathematically correct as that.
Well, I think
of course they fucking would.
I think it's kind of like the mythologizing of any great a group, like Kiss, where it was meant to be Knights in Satan's Service, right? That was,
yes,
but that was never, that's not actually true, is it?
No, not a couple of good Jewish boys from Brooklyn, which they are, were.
Hey, where do you fall on the Kiss? Are you a Kiss fan or no?
I was. If you're a really young person, there was a band called Kiss who unfortunately are still around. They really should not be doing anything.
They were good. They're all set to do a world tour before the pandemic. I was seeing billboards for them at the start of the year.
I was so into Kiss. Kiss were space creature superstars when in the late 70s, early 80s, when I was just kind of coming online as far as there's music that isn't Patsy Bisco, you know. When I was just kind of coming online, there was this band that dressed up in makeup and breathed fire and were like, wow, and there was dragons. And
if you're a 12-year-old, they're awesome. Like, they're everything that you want in a band. It's rock and roll with superheroes combined.
They really were. And then when it came to be in bands when I was like 15 years old, our band, all we played was side A and side D from Kiss Alive 1.
Oh, really?
You wanted the best. You got the best. The hottest band in the land. Kiss. And so we literally play the first three songs, side A. So a double album, double LP, four sides. First three songs and the last three songs, ending with Rock and Roll All Night, Party Every Day. Later in life, I started to learn what kind of person Gene Simmons actually was. I'm like, oh, no. And then I had met someone that had dinner with him when they were on tour in Australia. And she, anyway, terrible people make great art.
Yeah.
All right. And that's the thing that we have to come to grips with. And it's really, really hard to understand. And you have to come to grips in this world of I'm so pure. I don't follow anyone on Twitter that's ever said anything wrong. And if they have, I've unfollowed them. It's very hard to accept. Terrible people make great art. And flawed people learn lessons as well. So you've got to understand that as well. But
there's not a lot of Kiss in my life ever. But, anymore. There used to be daily, but now no.
But it's interesting, right? Because I look, everything you said, I 100% agree with. I've never ever heard anyone say anything good about Gene Simmons. Like, I know like hardcore Kiss fans who have been completely turned off Kiss because of the Gene factor. But it's always the Gene factor. And I know he is like the primary driving force. But Paul Stanley, on the other hand, I think comes across quite well. Like every interview I've seen, I've never heard anyone say anything bad about him. I've never seen him come across and say anything controversial. Like he seems to be quite a nice guy. It's the gene of it all.
Well, it's early on in the internet stuff. Like some of the thing, one thing, early on in the internet world when domain names were valuable things. Mm. All right. So charlieclawson.com. It's you. It's who you are. It's your brand. You should own it. And if anyone else owns it, they like, why do I have this? You know, I sell custom cricket balls. I'm not Charlie Clawson. And you go to them and say, hey, I'm Charlie Clawson. This is who I am, my brand, my business. I should really own that. That's my name. It's mine. And they go, yeah, okay. Or, you know, you exchange a small fee. The story goes, the legend has it, that Gene Simmons goes like, all right. And he just squatted all these band domain names, like huge band domain names. Like, I don't know what at the time, like I'm going to make names up, but something like Sepultura and, you know, big names like that. And then demanded money. Said, oh yeah, I've got it. You can buy it off me. I'm like, fuck you, man. Like, I'm out.
Yeah. I remember the first time I saw them in concert, I had an older brother who was like way into Kiss. He was right in the demo when they broke. He was like a teenager in the late 70s, early 80s. And so I remember going up to his bedroom and listening to Destroyer on vinyl and like, you know, rocking out and stuff. But then didn't actually see them until they were way past their prime in, I'd say like early 2000s. And I had a friend who was a drummer who was like, oh, you've got to come to a Kiss show. They're so fun. Like, it's just completely ridiculous and over the top. And so he went, and I was very cynical. I was like, I'm not going to enjoy this. Like, I feel my time has passed. And it was a really fun show. It was like really, really fun. It was like a good, fun rock and roll show. And then we went back to my friend's place afterwards, and he had like a bunch of like DVDs and stuff like that. And he put on a DVD from like the mid 80s. And it was exactly the same show. Like, I'm talking right all the bits that were like the fun ad libs and then bringing on the guests to play this bit and, you know, the dueling guitars and all that kind of stuff. It was all the same. It was like seeing like a stand up, you know, in 1980 doing the same jokes like 30 years later.
There's an amazing, I'm Googling it right now because I want to try and find it. There is a, I think it's like a 90-minute long. Hang on a second. Paul Stanley. What would it be? It'll be Paul Stanley crowd work clean. It's just like pulled from every here it is. 4 to 5 minutes of Paul Stanley's Take Your Time. It's seriously, it's fucking amazing. All right. It's just all of the, there's no music. It's just Paul Stanley.
All right! Toronto! You feel good! All right, then, listen. You know, we may be under clear blue skies, but you know, it's getting a little cool out tonight, but that ain't gonna stop us, because if we try hard enough, we're gonna get this place! I said we're gonna get this place!
Hotter than hell!
Hotter than hell!
No music. It does this for 45 minutes.
Oh, my God. That's my
I'm just ASMR. Scrolling forward.
I can go to sleep listening to that.
It just goes on and on and on and on. Anybody allowed to taste of alcohol?
See,
but
that just proves my point, that it's like Paul Stanley is quite lovable. I mean, that's what you love about Kiss, is the Paul Stanley of it. Gene Simmons can go fuck himself, but that is what you want, right?
It's so silly. I remember going to, I've seen Kiss, thankfully, I've seen Kiss a few times, right? Mm. I've seen them makeup off. The first time I saw them was makeup off. Oh, and gross. Then they came back makeup on. And it was just, it was musical. It was the wrestling, you know. Everyone in the room was aware of the kayfabe of the situation. You know, here's some dudes who are late 50s in makeup, wearing Spanx, just doing the same moves. And they even did the dance from Deuce. And everyone in the room was like, and we don't care. Yeah. We understand that these are old men dressed up in big boots, and there's, you know, fuck, it was loud though. Jesus, they had these concussion pyros that would just get the big rock finishes. God, it's just unnecessary amounts of volume.
But it's funny, but that genre of music, because as a kid, I think you look at, I mean, I know it's not strictly metal, but you look at the sort of metal as a wider genre of music, and it seems so dangerous and badass and stuff. And then the older you get, you're like, it's all nerds. Like, everyone who listens to this is nerds. Because I remember, I think it was Machine Gun Fellatio with the opening act for one of their tours. And is it Pinky? And he did an interview, and he's saying
Pinky Duscadero.
Yeah.
No, not Pinky Duscadero.
That's from Happy Days.
So Leather
Pinky Beecroft.
Pinky Beecroft, that's it.
And he was saying that, like, they would cop a lot of shit from the Kiss crowd when they would come out. Because if you ever saw an MGF show, they were always, like, you know, big costumes and, you know, fairly over the top. Mm. And they would get, like, booed and heckled by the Kiss audience. And he's always like, I don't understand it. Like, so we're taking it too far, but you've just paid $100 to see a bunch of, like, middle-aged men come out in spandex and platform shoes wearing makeup. Yet somehow we're ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah. And the last time I saw Kiss, because if you know anything about the story, it's Paul Stanley and Gene Simmons, they are Kiss. Mm. And then there was Ace Frehley and Eric Carr. And who was before Eric Carr? I can't remember the other drummer. Peter Criss was
Peter
the drummer
Criss.
Before that.
Yeah, the cat.
Various other musicians have come and gone playing lead guitar and drums. And the last time I saw Kiss in makeup, they hired people to dress up as Peter Criss and Ace Frehley. Like, he had Trace Frehley makeup on with the Ace Frehley outfit, with the Les Pauls and the fireworks, just playing the role of Ace Frehley. It was panto. It was almost like a Gwar show, but for Kiss.
Yeah.
Speaking of costumes, have you ever seen Gwar?
Yeah, of course.
Gwar's fucking amazing. If you don't know, I've never seen Gwar, watch some fucking Gwar. It's like a musical version of Squid Game, but from the 80s. And it's beyond, like, there's pus and buckets of blood and, like, all kinds of shit live. And they have a slave pit on stage. I remember my mate coming around ages ago with we all had that mate who starts smoking pot first. And he left school. And he came around one day when he was supposed to be at school. He was like not at school. And I was like, I don't go to school. Can I come around? I'm like, yeah, sure, come around. Yeah. And he came around with some weed and a guava video. And fair to say, my life changed that day. I was like, oh, all right. So you can be in a club with 500 people just kind of heaving all over each other and spray blood and, like, pre-Rammstein, just weird liquid all over the crowd. And the crowd's just loving it. And then there was a slave pit in the stage which would open up and people would jump and just be pushing each other out of the way to get into this slave pit. They would close the trap doors on it. And then what was his name? There was, I know Sexecutioner was in the band, and there was someone else. I can't remember. They had the most ridiculously brilliant names. And they would, you know, stand on top and, you know, dribble and pour all kinds of shit all over the crowd. The crowd was fucking all over it. Mm. It was just bananas. I loved it.
Because I often wonder if, you know, that's the, like, rock and roll as a genre. Because I love that. And I love the showmanship, and I love that it's fun and it's entertaining and theatrical. You know,
sorry, Paul Stanley started playing again. Sorry, I hit my space bar reaching.
What's Stanley he saying now?
Hold on. Come on.
Let's just check in with Paul.
You know, I'm not talking. I know it's getting close to Christmas, but I'm not talking about glug.
Dropping a bit of local liquor. He must be in Sweden or something.
I love glug.
Like, the fuck?
Glug? Who's drinking
it's like,
glug?
Like, nobody rocks like Brisbane. Yeah. It's like, you literally learned the name of my town 2 minutes before you walked up there, mate. Pull your fucking finger out.
Well, I saw he posted on Instagram. He had COVID, and he thanked all the doctors, and now he's fully vaccinated. He did a pro vaccination post, which is nice for a celebrity to do these days. It was a photo of him. I think he must have been at Venice Beach or something on his bike, a bit like you, Osh, on his bike in his Lycra, and thanking all the doctors in modern medicine for, you know, protecting him or saving him from COVID.
Paul Stanley rides a bicycle?
Yeah, it was the most unusual thing, because he also has one of those faces too where he's had a little bit of work done, old Paul. Like, he looks constantly surprised at the moment. Like, I saw a photo of Megan Fox at, I think it was like the Met Gala or something recently, and I'm like, Paul Stanley and Megan Fox have the same face right now.
They really do.
It's that Botox kind of high arched eyebrows kind of look. But no, he definitely is a cyclist. I mean, you might have even ridden past him when you lived in LA.
I don't know. He rides a flat bar. He rides a flat bar bike. And
when he says he's passing you, do you think he does it in falsetto? Like, passing!
I'm just on your right! Yeah! Oh, man. I'm looking at the picture of his bike here. That's a beautiful little electric bike here. Low gear ratio. Nice one, Stanley. I met him once, and he had, I think, like, he's got a very recognizable face. As you mentioned, he's got very recognizable eyebrows and a very recognizable pout.
Mm.
But I met him once after a gig in Brisbane at a meet and greet. And he had the bandana, the Andre Agassi just owning it kind of bandana, the one that starts above the eyebrows and goes halfway up the head.
Yeah.
He had that and then what was very clearly a wig. So I'm wondering if after the show they just go whoop and they just become, I don't know, I'm Gordon, the tour manager.
Yeah, right.
Paul Stanley. He's in the lift behind
it's
me.
Like,
and they just carry on.
It's like the Bourne Identity where he just like rips off the sky so he can just meld into the crowd and exit with everyone else.
Yeah. Jackie Daytona from What We Do in the Shadows taking the toothpick out. Fuck, I love that set. That episode is so good.
Hey,
have you seen the one with the Mark Hamill episode?
No.
Of What We Do in the Shadows?
No.
Oh! You've got to watch it. What We Do in the Shadows is one of the more excellently produced American comedy.
Oh, so it's the American version, not the Kiwi one?
Yeah. It's a series, and it's so fucking good. We're watching it the second time, Audrey and I watching it for a second time, and it's worth it.
I have not watched TV properly for months now. I mean, as you know, I'm kind of in a, I'm in a state of kind of stasis at the moment. I am on the road, but not quite on the road. I'm sort of jumped the border a few months ago to Queensland and then sort of got stuck here. And because of the nature of we've been moving around a lot, I have not watched anything. And so it's very hard to feel so out of the cultural zeitgeist when you see people tweeting about like the mayor of Eastdown and then now it's Squid Game. So I'm trying very hard to catch up to the 4,000 hours of television that I have missed in the past, like, well, since Iona was born, really, like, I realized I have not been to a cinema. I have not been to a movie in 2 years since my daughter was born.
No, us neither. Not since Wolfie.
But you
Wolfie
have readily born. Available babysitters. Why have you not taken advantage of that?
Because of fucking lockdown. We can't go
of course.
We can't go anywhere. We can't do anything.
You had like a year-ish before that to do it.
Yeah, and then you're like, baby's in bed. Fuck, let's get some food in us before.
Yeah. Do you also feel too like, Iona's just turned two a couple of weeks ago and now it's a whole new kettle of fish. Like, she's saying heaps of words now. Like, she seems like a, you know, just, and I'm always like in my head, how could I possibly ask anyone to look after this kid when I'm still trying to figure it out? Like, I'm like, how do I get her to settle? How do I get her to calm down? What do I do when she does this, when she does that? Like, if a babysitter or someone came around, a relative was like, yeah, I'll take her, I wouldn't even know where to begin with, like, if she does this, do that, because I don't know. I'm still trying to figure it out. Do you feel the same way?
Absolutely. Wolfie's only just gone back into daycare. So we got him into daycare. We waited for the good daycare. Like, we waited an extra year until we could get to the good one, right? Mm. And we got in there and it's fucking amazing, right? It's amazing. And a week later, lockdown.
Mm.
Lockdown 2. So, fuck. So we pulled him out. And on our first picnic weekend, when it was like we were free to have picnics about 2 or 3 weeks ago, he was interacting with another one of Audrey's mother's group friends, with, you know, one of the kids who's very, very close to his age. And straight away we saw, oh, fuck, all he's doing is hanging around adults.
Yeah.
Fuck, we've got to get him. He needs to be around human beings at his eye level. He needs to, you know, because he learns by watching and he needs to see other kids figuring stuff out. And we're doing him a disservice by not letting him interact with other kids. And so we put him back in. And yesterday was his first, we've been working him up to full days there because he's just been around us the whole time. And so yeah. Yesterday was his first full day there. And yeah, he didn't sleep, which is understandable. Apparently the first couple of times they go there, they don't sleep. They just kind of hang out in the big cot room. And so he didn't sleep there. And when I picked him up, the lovely, lovely teacher, who's so great, she's an absolute delight. She gave me the full debrief. When I picked him up, I just held him and I'm like, he's the only 2-year-old I've ever raised, and I don't think he's ever missed a lunch nap. What do I do? Mm. I've still got no fucking clue.
Yeah.
She's like, oh, try to get him to as close as, you know, bedtime as you can, and, you know, just keep an eye on him, and, you know, thank you.
Yeah, it's like, more than me.
I've got no, you know, from all the stuff we've done on Dadpod, I've got no problem asking everybody else because everyone else has solved the problems first. You know, I'm not going to pretend I know what to do.
But you don't, and it's sort of unique to every child and every situation, like every home, how your home life is set up. You know, who's going to, are you co-parenting? Is one parent working full time? Is it like all that kind of stuff changes it? I mean, I have the same concerns. Iona was loving daycare, like loving it. She at first was very resistant to it and then couldn't wait to get there. She was so excited, loved her teachers and stuff. But like you, we've pulled her out and she has had, like, you know, the playgrounds are still open in Queensland. So she'll play with kids, but she's not having that full-time interaction. And I'm starting to go, she needs to be around other kids soon, doesn't she? Like, she can't keep having these conversations with me. Also, I don't think I can keep having conversations with her because I feel like I need to talk to some adults as well. Because that's the other thing that we're missing up here is we don't have any friends, or we have like a couple of friends, but not a lot. And it's like, it's me and Jem and the baby. And it's like, this is great. And I love my family and this is the way it should be. But I think all of us need to start seeing other people.
I saw a friend this morning. We caught up for a smoothie. I saw a friend this morning and, you know, we're still in masks in public places in Sydney and things like that. And I hadn't seen him for a long time. And because daycare, you can, oh, wow, quick, go do stuff.
Oh, my God.
Audrey studies on Fridays. So Audrey's studying all day, doing Zoom still. She's still doing Zoom. She's not on campus yet. And I squeezed him on the arm. And I'm like, you're the first person that I've squeezed that isn't someone I'm related to or I don't live with in a year. I haven't hugged anyone that isn't my wife or my son in nearly 2 years. It's fucking weird.
Yeah.
And I'm so lucky. I think about it all the time. There's people in my life who are single. It's been a long fucking time to not have that
physical contact,
physical touch. And it's such an important thing for us as human beings. We've got to have it. I mean, you know, you see what happens to babies if you don't touch them. It's horrendous.
Mm.
We've got to be the same as adults and interacting with other people. It's important for our brains. It's important for how our brains work. And yeah. What part of Brisbane are you? Vaguely, what part of Brisbane are you in?
Oh, we're not in Brisbane. Outside? We're back on the Gold Coast now. We were just in Brisbane. We've basically been bouncing between the two as work has dictated. Because, I mean, I've told the story a zillion times on my other shows. But so, yeah, Jim and I jumped the border in order to stay mobile because at that stage we had work on the offing in WA, in Victoria, and then everything got shut down. And then all production has moved to Queensland. So it's like, well, we might as well stay here and, like, take the work that's on offer up here. So, between Brisbane and the Gold Coast. So we're in the southern Gold Coast at the moment. And I've got to say, Osh, like, I've never spent a significant amount of time in Queensland and had always been fairly like, oh, I don't think I'm really a Queensland kind of guy. I don't know if it's Stockholm Syndrome, but I think I'm starting to become a Queensland, well, parts of Queensland kind of guy. Like, the southern Gold Coast is beautiful. It is so nice down here, you know, like sort of around Currumbin and Talabudgera and Burley and all those areas. Like, it's really, really nice. It's not the kind of craziness of when people think of Gold Coast, they think surfers paradise, and that is its own thing. And I don't really spend much time there, but It's much more like family oriented, but to the point where Jim and I are now going, maybe we should start looking like property up in Queensland. I mean, we're sort of northern New South Wales as it is. So should we just like keep going further north? Because it's just, and I quite like Brisbane as well. Although I did text you a couple of weeks ago to say, how does anyone cope with this heat? I mean, it's not even sunny yet. And I was melting up there. It is so hot in Brisbane. Like, what are you meant to do?
Great. I love it. I loved it. Well, firstly, like you, Bailey Smith, and most of the NRL have probably all spent the last 6 months going, actually, it's pretty fucking good. Goodbye.
Yeah. See you later, shirt. Well, I got a mate who lives in Brisbane. He moved from Byron to Brisbane a couple of years ago, and he still travels back and forth. And so I'll see him from time to time. And he's always in the same outfit. Like, I'm pretty sure it's like the same shorts or same two pairs of shorts and the same T-shirt or two T-shirts. And then having spent 2 weeks just recently in Brisbane, I'm like, oh, I understand why. Because it's so goddamn hot. You're just going to pull on the lightest thing you have. And it's going to get sweaty and stuff. So why bother changing? Because you're just going to ruin it. So just stay in the same sweaty clothes and just wear them until they melt off your body and find another T-shirt and shorts to wear.
I once went a whole year not wearing long pants.
Oh, it's crazy though. But what do you do?
It's easy to do.
In the peak of summer, like, do people just not – is it like Spain where people just take siestas in the middle of the day and don't leave the house? I mean, I was going out taking Ayanna to the park. And I'm like, it's too hot. We can't play. We're just going to have to hide in the shade and we're going to have to text Gemma to come pick us up because it's too hot to walk home.
You do get – you get used to it, but you'd most definitely never leave the house without shoes. Like, you get used to it. You acclimate. And I most certainly did. I remember when I got to Sydney, I mean, I still go into the ocean with a wetsuit on.
Cold,
everyone around
me
is just in boardies. I'm like, you fucking weirdos.
But do you think do you think it is the thing that heat? It's why some Queenslanders speak so slowly.
Do you think without
it has to do with the heat?
Because
there
the
is
further
that
north
kinda,
you get.
Yeah, it's just a slower pace up here, and I think it's
the
gotta
further
be
north
heat.
You get, the slower and weirder it becomes. The closer you get, it's why they say he's gone tropo. The further north you get, the stranger it is. Until you start to get to like Agnes Waters and 1770 and stuff like that, and it's glorious, but it's pretty odd. It's pretty odd up there. Lovely though, absolutely glorious. Brizzo is amazing. Brizzo is not the town. When I left it was a cow town in 98.
Yeah.
And now it's just this amazing. It's got a
it's
W hotel.
So
and
trendy,
all
man.
Kinds of shit.
But it really it's does. Amazing. It's actually got a bit of a vibe. I remember telling you when I was last spent some time up there, we were doing a dad pod, and I was saying to you how I'd gone to the Museum of Modern Art, and they had an exhibition about the history of music in Brisbane, which had all sort of kicked off with the bicentennial, you know, and they built all these kind of venues and stuff. And then all these bands came and played in this sort of like, not Renaissance, but this golden era in the 90s when all these like bands in Brisbane just exploded. And I had no idea that there was a kind of Blur versus Oasis rivalry between like Regurgitator and Powderfinger. And
oh, absolutely.
It
was amazing.
It's so amazing.
Yeah, it was super fun. And Brizzo's great. You know, half my family's still up there, and we can't get anywhere near it. But it's glorious. And the part where you are, if you go inland from where you are too, it's absolutely beautiful. Jump up into the hinterland up behind the Golden Coast.
Well, it's only 10 minutes drive to get into the hinterland. That's the thing. It's so
just
close. Like, because it's funny. I went and did a table read for a show out at the studios, the Village Roadshow studios out near the theme parks. And I was like, oh, this makes perfect sense why this should be the new Hollywood. Apparently Baz Luhrmann is relocating his entire production facilities and his office up to the Gold Coast because he shot Elvis up there last year. And he's like, well, this is going to be the new Hollywood. And it does have that kind of vibe where it's like, well, if you want ocean, it's 10 minutes that way. If you want hills, it's 10 minutes that way. If you want this entire kind of variety of settings, and then you've got all this space that you can build giant studios and film in there.
Yeah. And there's also that new studio set building up in Byron, up in the hinterland there in Byron. There's a whole new studio going in there around the old quarry.
Is that definitely happening?
Far as I know. Right.
Yeah. I've heard. It's funny because I should probably stay off the Byron Bay Community Board on Facebook because Boy, oh boy. Just don't read the comments. Like the anti-vax nonsense there is insane. Like it'll drive you mental. But you do sort of see a lot of people kind of backing it. I don't know what's real and what's not. I should probably staying off Facebook as a rule is probably a good thing, right?
I absolutely agree. There's Facebook groups, man. Just Facebook generally is not a good thing for
discussion.
Not good for your mental health. It's not good for society. It's not good for democracy. It's the
well. You saw what that whistleblower was saying a few days ago. That woman who came out and said that, you know, their entire business model, and this is not, you know, new information, but they are more like the Mark Zuckerberg, who has like the controlling majority in Facebook, which means he's essentially the most powerful controller of information in the entire world. They find it more profitable to be able to broadcast misinformation than to restrict or limit what people can post. Because obviously, if you can speak to your particular bubble, even if that bubble is kind of like into paranoid conspiracies or whatever, then they're going to click more because it's the hate clicks. And if you can create, all that kind of tension amongst different groups, then you're going to get more people on you, which means you get more advertising. And so she was saying that they don't really have a kind of, a business ethics charter at Facebook. It's literally just driven by profits and algorithms. And so Zuckerberg came out he released some statement the day after saying something along the lines of, I don't know, you know, what advertiser would want their brand associated with like hate speech. And it's like, it's not about hate speech, mate. It's about the clicks. Like that's what people want to know is, am I getting eyeballs on my page?
It's, That in itself is no surprise, and I guess a part of it as well. And I've spoken about this on my show a bit with people who are far more versed in it than I. I'm old, or I'm nearly 50. I've got a fake hip. I've got hearing aids. Like, I'm cranky. I've grey hair. So bear in mind, I've seen my country change a lot since I was a kid, and I've seen various ideas and thoughts show up in culture that were never really there. Case in point, when I was a kid, when I was a little kid, fanny was always your butt. And then sometime in my teens, fanny became the vagina.
Hang on, fanny was never butt. Fanny was always vagina.
Not in Queensland, not really? Where I grew up. Fanny was always your butt. Right. Fanny was your butt.
Okay.
And then fanny became the vagina. I was like, where did that, how did that suddenly change? All right. And then... Well, it makes more sense because fanny fart's a funny thing to say. Anyway, there's certain things, certain sort of ways of thinking that have incepted into our culture.
Yeah.
And the idea that the people that get, it's a bit of a hot take, but the people that get these jobs, these coding jobs, and, you know, create these startups for these, you know, that then get acquired by Facebook Inc. or Alphabet, which owns Google and stuff like that. They were, you know, they're the guys that kind of just sat there and just wrote code, maybe didn't interact much, maybe didn't socialize much, and just maybe went, oh, what would a perfect world be? A perfect world would be if this and that and this and that. And okay, so I'll write that into the algorithm. And that kind of weird libertarian American, kind of modern libertarian thought that was never in Australia, was never here,
yeah,
has kind of showed up in the last 5 to 10 years.
You're 100% right.
And it's really weird. Yeah. It's really weird to have these... You know, could have American libertarian politics suddenly show up in a country that never associated with that. It's not, we are an individualistic society, but we're not a hyper individualistic society like America.
Yeah.
We are not stepping over homeless people in the street going, should have had insurance, mate. We have empathy, we have compassion. And it's fucking weird, man. I find it really, really strange and really quite dangerous. And that the, like, all you have to look at is any example, and there's many and varied examples of Facebook community group stacks-ons. Before you know it, you know, someone accuses someone of something, and before you know it, an entire community group's behind it, and then people are posting shit on, you know, people's home addresses and photos of kids and all kinds of stuff. Like, that fucking never happens.
Yeah.
Never happened. And now it's this dangerous kind of world where that shit... goes on. Thank fuck we don't have firearms readily available in this country.
I wanted to talk to you about You know, you and I have both been fans of Joe Rogan in the past and listening to the Joe Rogan podcast.
It was one of my favorite unfollows of the last month.
Oh, it's weird, man. Like, I really, since he switched to Spotify, I probably haven't listened at all or been that aware. And then I took a dip back in and it's like, oh shit. Because I remember even actually you and I texting back and forth a couple of years ago where he was talking about the kids in detention at the border, and you sent me a clip where he'd gone on this rant saying, you know, that's just not how we treat other humans and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, that's good that, you know, he's saying that. But I just wish he was a bit more judicious in his guests, like who he's platforming. Cut to 2 years later, and it's like he feels like he's gone full right wing. Like the last thing I heard him talking about was like about a week ago, he had some ex-CIA guy on, and they're talking about Australia, and they're talking about those freedom protests that were happening in Melbourne. And he was trying to make Joe Rogan was trying to make the point that this is what happens when you give up your guns. You give up your guns, and then you allow yourself to become that we're willingly compliant to authoritarian regimes. And it's like, hang on. First of all, get fucked. The cognitive dissonance to talk about, you know, they've lost all their freedoms when, what about the freedom of like a high school kid being able to go to school and not have to do active shooter drills, you know?
I agree. Like I understand why some people write into him and some of the thought that he exposes people to, I know I'm certainly not ready to process. You know, some of the people he has on, I'm like, I don't know if I'm ready to listen to that with an objective mind. They're so persuasive in their argument. The arguments they're choosing to represent their thesis is just so convincing, and they speak with such passion. I might just get swept up in this and believe it to be true. I don't really, like, know that I need to protect myself a bit to not get swayed so quickly. Because if you dig it, you know, if you scratch the surface a bit, you know, a lot of it does tend to fall apart. And I know I'm not prepared to process a lot of some of the things that his guests come on to say, but I don't know if everybody is. I don't know if people kind of look at it and read it like a grainy JPEG, you know, of a cougar with some sort of, you know, mama bear protects their child vaccine statement written on it. And they suddenly go, that's true. Like, I don't know. Is it?
Yeah.
Is it true? Like, I'm able to listen to some of his more divisive guests and go, and this is why I did enjoy his show.
Yeah.
Because like, it was my way to expose myself to other patterns and thoughts that were not within my initial kind of, you know, community, and go, wow, I disagree with that, what that person's saying, quite vehemently, and I can feel my body reacting to it. But okay, well, at least I can now have an idea of what's going on that side of the fence and carry on over here. But now, I don't know. I think it's quite dangerous, in fact. I think it's quite dangerous. We have, to borrow one of his phrases, and it's kind of right. He says, we had 70 mile per hour speed limits and no seat belts for years until we figured out maybe dropping speed limits and putting seat belts on is probably a good idea. And his line is like, that's kind of where we are. That's kind of where we are with social media and where we are with independent broadcasting. He might be one of those people going 70 through a school zone with no seatbelt on right now.
Yeah.
And what we're starting to see is the kind of crackdowns. And it's coming. Seatbelt's coming.
What I used to enjoy about and what I felt the show was I always thought it was odd that people criticized him for being right wing, because I'm like, well, I feel like it's a fairly broad church, the Joe Rogan, you know, not only just their audience, but also the guests he had on, because it felt like he had a real balance of, you know, people from all over the political spectrum. But just recently, and the stuff he's been saying, it's funny because there's a lot of journalists, I don't know if you follow, like on YouTube and stuff, there's a lot of, if someone classes themselves as an independent journalist or an alternative to the mainstream, I'm always like, okay, that's interesting. I'll hear what they have to say. But generally they always end up being right wing. Like, yeah, they position themselves as being independent, but what they are really is they lean closer to the right. They set themselves up as like, we are not the mainstream. We are not the status quo. We don't believe in it. But that then tends to push them down. I know that there are, you know, left-leaning versions of this, but the majority of the more popular ones, like the Tim Pools and guys like that, they all tend to be right-wing. Even though they say, I'm a libertarian, you know, I'm an independent, I believe in freedom. It's like, well, yeah, but I think that you've also, this idea of personal freedom being the most sacrosanct thing that we have, I actually think that, you know, community is something that we need to preserve as well, and making decisions that benefit the community, not just what benefits you or what you believe is right for you and your family. Because that's the way I understand the American model is like, well, you look after yourself, and when you look after yourself, you can look after your family. When you look after your family, then you can look after your friends. And, you know, and that's, you start with you and work out. But I think that the idea of like, well, as a community, why don't we all come together and let's figure out what the best thing for all of us is. I understand that that can be complicated and harder to do and slower and ineffective, and governments do fuck things up and they misspend funds and all that kind of stuff. But like you were saying before, I think that Australia used to have a better grasp on that, a better sense of like community spirit.
I couldn't agree with you anymore. But like, that can be taken to the super extreme fucked up level where, you know, there are some collectivist societies north of us that may be, you know, pushing that to its absolute limits.
Hang on, let me just turn off my Huawei. So we don't get red flagged.
Red flag, see what you did there?
Oh, yeah.
You know, where no matter what your personal choice is, it doesn't have, it's never as ever as important as what the state needs.
Yeah.
Yet I would say to you, Charlie, what you've just described is the very reason that humans became the most dominant species on the planet, because thought around protecting a community and acting as a community and acting as a group is what allowed us. We're not stronger than a mammoth. We're not stronger than an elephant. We're not stronger than a lion.
Well, you might not be.
But 20 of us are.
That's right.
20 of us can, one person can't kill a buffalo. 20 people can take down a buffalo. And by working as a community and working together for the greater good, that is what allowed us. And I believe in many ways we've evolved that way, and we're designed that way, and our brains have responded to community protection and community in many ways. And I agree with you, man. I completely agree with you that there's somewhere between that, you know, I take my fucking guns and I don't take my fucking guns. I'm here by myself and I'm protecting my family but ultimately, what does that leave you? It leaves you like alone with lots of cans of baked beans in the basement and hoping you don't run out of bullets, versus everyone I know in my community knows who I am. I knew who everybody is. We are all aware of each other and we're here to keep our community safe. And I know which society I'd prefer to be in.
Well, have you ever seen a documentary called I Am? I can't remember the filmmaker behind it. It was the guy who directed the Ace Ventura movies. And so the documentary starts and he was the biggest comedy director in Hollywood, you know, getting paid millions of dollars to make these Jim Carrey blockbusters, Liar Liar and all this kind of stuff. And he talks about like buying his third, like, you know, mansion in Malibu and arriving at this big house and putting his bags down and just going, God, why do I feel so miserable and depressed? And so this documentary is a journey of him sort of speaking to psychologists and sociologists and, you know, theologists about like, well, what is the purpose of being here? And, you know, why, you know, is this pursuit of the material so unfulfilling? And it's really fascinating. And he talks to one, I believe it's a sociologist, who talks about this idea that, you know, everyone always quotes that Darwin thing of the survival of the fittest, you know, and there's alpha males in the jungle and there's always one dominant, you know, dominant animal who leads the others, and that's why you need strong leaders. So if you want to be successful in this world, then you need to be ruthless and you need to be alpha and you need to be all these things. And that's actually misquoting what Darwin said. Like, the longer quote essentially is like, well, you know, it is survival of the fittest, but there is actually more examples in nature of cooperation being beneficial than one person, you know, or one leader taking them in a certain direction. And, you know, they show this sort of footage of, I think it's like gazelles or something in the Sahara. And when they are looking for water in the middle of the day, when the sun's at its hottest and they're, you know, thirsty, it's not like one gazelle's like, all right, dickheads, listen up. We're heading in this direction. The herd will just move around until eventually, like, once the 51st percentile of that group starts heading in one direction, that's when they will head off in that direction and find water. And that's more common in, you know, nature and in the animal world than, yeah, the alpha, the idea of there being like, you know, one silverback who's like, this is what we're doing.
Mm. There's a book, a great book called Humankind by Rutger Bregman, which is fantastic, really, really great book. And he expands on that Darwin quote as well, and he has a whole chapter about it. And he kind of reframes the whole chapter. It's a fascinating read. It's not so much survival of the fittest, is that if you look at human history, if you look at human evolution, if you look at how we became the dominant species of the planet, it's survival of the friendliness, survival of the friendliest.
Yeah.
We are designed, we are wired to cooperate. We are not designed to be, you know, to fight against each other or be, as you mentioned, one person to beat everybody else down, because then what are you? You are, it's like the end of, it's the end of Survivor, but without the tribal council where you get to go, I'm sorry, guys, I had to.
Yeah, yeah.
I had to. Look, I've won the thing. The pyro has gone off. I'm sorry I had to lie to you all. You then now have to live with everyone that you lied to and destroyed and beat down and manage all that, which is, I guess, then that's how you get the bullshit the bullshit democracy situation we have at the moment, where it's all about keeping everyone in the party room behaving so they don't come for your neck and knife you in the back and have a spill and take your leadership off you, which is how we end up in this fucking ridiculous situation where 4% of our population of Australia voted for the National Party, all right? Yet these handful of ministers, Barnaby, Christensen and Canavan, are now, you know, deciding, I don't know, $250 billion, that's a good amount of money to open brand new coal mines when everywhere else in the world's like, no more coal. Who's going to be left holding the fucking bag? You know, no one's going to, like, it's just, this is bullshit. But they have to say yes to them in case they fucking knife them before the next election. It's just fucked. Sorry. I'm very angry about it.
No. Australian politics, I mean, you talk about the social media culture changing the culture of Australia. Like, how uninspiring has Australian politics been in the last 20 years?
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Like, I've met him, and he was incredible to talk to, and it's bananas to believe he was once the leader of the Conservative Party, now the Australian Liberal Party. I did a speaking gig with Dr. John Houston once.
Mm.
Keating leaning over the thing again. No, mate, I'm going to do you slowly. Like, that shit is fucking balls deep.
But it's
I also loved it, like
the vision. It's like the lack of vision, the lack of imagination. Yeah. Because you're right, like, yeah, especially with Scott Morrison, it feels like everything is so market tested with him. Every statement, every decision he makes, yeah, it's so calculated. And it all feels like politics. And I mean, people, even if you are like a beloved politician, like a super popular beloved politician, the JFK or Barack Obama or Bob Hawke or whatever, you know, people are still suspicious that you're a politician. Like, if you're a politician, it's like being a used car salesman. Like, you could be the greatest orator or whatever, but people are still inherently suspicious of your motivations. Now it feels like they've just done away with the mask. Like, it's like, no, yeah, we objectively will let you know about the deals we're making with the minor parties in order to maintain power. Like, mm-hmm. Barnaby Joyce as much came out and said it. Like, why isn't George Christensen being disciplined over his anti-vax comments? And it's like, well, we need his vote. Like, that's not a moral stance. That's craven. That's so terrible.
It's fucking, it's ridiculous. And just the like, not even pretending to, like, that $600 million on car parks or whatever,
oh, yeah,
only for the people. It's like, not even pretending.
Yeah.
It's just,
I mean,
it's
even with, like, with what happened with Gladys, you know, resigning because of this corruption investigation and the eulogies that were being written about her. I'm like, hang on, did I miss something? Did she resign because of some, she's been investigated for corruption. Like, she stood aside because her position was no longer tenable. Yet people are talking about her as if it's like, oh, she was forced out. It's like, I don't understand, what is the point of having an independent corruption watchdog if when they do their job, you're like, oh, they've got too much power. They're targeting politicians. That's what they should be doing. Politicians should. Barnaby Joyce said a couple of days ago, oh, God, now you got me ranting, that, you know, these watchdogs are making politicians scared to say or do anything. Good, fucking good. They should be. They should be scared. Yeah. It's ridiculous.
Power needs to be held to account. Power, and in a time when the press cannot hold the power to account because of the business model of the press changing so much, when the press have to align themselves to keep their money coming in and align themselves and barely, they cannot speak out or hold that power to account. That power to just uncheck powers, you know, we've all seen what that does. But it's no good. But power has to be held to account.
I do worry, like, where, because, you know, if I know we have many young listeners, but if we did, you've got to imagine, like, when Osh and I were kids and there was five channels, you got your news from certain sources and you trusted that those news sources had done their research and that they were telling you something that was more or less objectively true. But now, like you say, like the business models are changing and media companies are having to get in bed or play favorites with certain parties in order to get stories or get access. And so it's forcing more and more people, like the suspicion around media and the distrust of the mainstream media, I completely understand. But I also think that going now to these YouTube journalists or these, like, you know, Twitter journalists, these independent journalists who always end up being right wing, as far as I can tell, is not the solution. So what is the solution? Because we have this incredible resource where we should be able to be delivering, like, actual verified information around the world at lightning speed, but we're not. We're just muddying the waters so you can't determine what's true and what's not.
Mate, I think it all starts with democratic reform. It starts with democratic reform. It starts with funding reform. It starts with
getting lobbyists out of it,
you know. Yeah, or yeah, removing lobbyists and making every meeting a politician, you know, holds as many meetings as possible that a politician holds live streamed.
Ah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Live streamed from their office. I want to hear, you know, I want to hear. I want to hear when, you know, when a politician meets, you know, such and such from such and such mining company, you know, that the politician's like three or four underlings mates down, you know, someone five people removed gets a phone call going, okay, so we can put the trading trust in someone's name and the shares will go to their grandchildren so they'll never know that it was, you know, and they get vetted and the shares will come live in 20 years and we want a tick of approval on the hole in the ground. That shit goes on, man, and I want that stuff to be out there. And for me, it's democratic reform. For me, it's changing the way that our democracies run. It's take money out of politics and just create citizen juries. It's a thing called sortition. I'm a massive fan of it.
What is it?
I've done podcasts about
sortition.
It. Sortition. Sortition is called. Okay. Like, say, for example, say you committed a crime, you know, I give you a white-collar crime. Like
embezzlement.
You embezzled some money. Who would, and it went to trial, who would decide your fate?
In the current system.
Say you were looking at, you know, you did something pretty bad. Yeah. It's probably a couple million bucks involved. You stole some money from some pensioners. Who would decide your fate?
A jury of my peers.
Uh-huh. A jury of your peers. Now, these are people that are going to decide the outcome of your life, how often you'll see your children, you know, whether you're going to ever have a career, if you'll go to prison. Are those people elected?
No. Well, what do you mean elected? No. They're selected, but they're not elected, yeah.
They're randomly selected people from the population.
Yeah.
And they have control over the course of your life. They could potentially find you, you know, if the charge is big enough, put you away for 20 years, all right? Yet, the massive, enormous decisions that our the country has to make are made by, you know, it's just like, why do we think that someone like George Christensen could do a better job than a randomly group of selected people from the general public? It's bananas. All right. And people might go, oh, well, then you might get some, you know, bananas racist in there. Well, guess what? There's fucking bananas racists in there right now. So it's not going to be any better. And citizen juries, once you get like, they're pretty big. They can get to 300-600 people. Very, and you know, particularly if you're talking about the Australian governmental system, particularly with a coalition party, they have a party vote. They have to go along the party line.
Is there an existing this working at the moment?
There's been a few around the world. Absolutely. Like Switzerland, for example, does a very different job. Switzerland has referendums every 6 weeks. They're amazing, right? They've done a few in Australia. They did one in South Australia around whether or not to go ahead with a nuclear waste dump. that really interesting crew of people called New Democracy in Australia are pushing for it.
Okay.
And so basically what happens is, like, rather than one person, the party whip, going, this is how we're going to vote on this, and then 143 seats or whatever the majority is in the Australian government go, we're going to vote along that line. So you only really have to lobby one person, take one person to dinner, promise one person grandkids vetted shares in some sort of blind trust, boom, you're over the line. Very hard to sway 600 people.
Yeah.
Very hard. And so I personally think, like, that has to be the way forward for our
or at least at the very worst, you're just sort of finding out who are the most charismatic, influential people, and in which case, sure. I mean, if that person can convince 600 people,
yeah,
maybe they can lead a country. Yeah, go for it.
Perfect. Yeah, absolutely. And, like, there's a, yeah, I don't want to cross promo too much, but, like, there's,
no, please,
I've
do.
Spoken with James Matheson is the guy that first introduced me to the idea. Since then, I've done a whole bunch of digging, and, you know, I've found some really interesting people to talk to. There's another book that I would really recommend called Beyond Elections, which talks a lot about it, and it's a really, really good read. And if you're interested in anything that doesn't look like our current political system, if you're looking at March next year going, the fuck am I going to vote for? What, really? I'm going to vote for the party that's going to Stephen Bradbury it to the leadership. They're just not saying fucking anything, hoping that the other guys will just fuck themselves before then. That's no way to lead a country. So if that's really, I would jump into that book and look up what the New Democracy guys are doing, and really look real hard into the independent MPs in your area who are making solid climate forward policy. Because if you've got a climate policy, that you've got an economic policy. Because if you don't have a climate policy, the economic policy that we've got right now, nah, it's not going to fly. It's not going to work.
Yeah, I mean,
it's scary as fuck.
It's interesting, isn't it? Like, Australia has just, our current global stance on the climate is we are putting our fingers in our ears. We're not listening. It's amazing. I really thought of all the things that Australia would dig its heels in over. It wouldn't be this. A country that relies so heavily on tourism, you know, we've got the Great Barrier Reef. And it's like, oh, we'll just let that die. We'll let that die. We'll let the country burn. The driest continent on the planet. And it's like, we are not going to attend this summit. And we're just going to set our own targets, which were based on fudge numbers anyway.
It's an absolute shame. And thankfully, there are plenty of people in our community who are like, fuck no. I mean, look at the response to Dan Illick's joke.
So great.
All right. Like, that shows, that's got to show you that there's so many people, people who are probably for the most part quite centrist, who are like, this is ridiculous.
Well, when you,
I can read a chart.
When you do the polling, it's always in favor of, yeah, like, environmental concern, like, climate change is a huge priority, especially amongst young voters. It's just insane, like you say, that the government has been held hostage by this minority party, and that the opposition are not offering up anything. Like, do your job as the opposition. I always think, like, if they just came out on the front foot on one of these policies, they would win so many voters. But like you say, they're just like, no, we'll just wait and see. We'll just hold our breath. But that didn't work fucking last time, you idiots.
And it won't again. I mean, they've already pulled, that, you know, Tony Abbott's up there in Taiwan. I don't know what the fuck he's going to say today, but it's probably the day we're talking, Tony Abbott's making a speech in Taiwan, which is probably not going to be very good. Okay? And I don't know, like doing the nuclear deal with America and the UK, like, this is, they're going to, you know, rattle the war drums. They're going to, you know, this is an election they're going to have to go for with national security. They're going to make everyone afraid of China in this election. And it's fucking scary as fuck. Don't worry about the climate stuff. You should worry about China and the South China Sea.
Yeah.
Like, come on, man. Like, please. That whole thing fucking terrifies me. I mean, sure. Do I want nice Joe Biden American military cooperation? Yeah, that'd be nice. Do I want the third version of Donald Trump in 25 years? Fucking no, because that's what we've signed up for. Mm. And that's terrifying.
Yeah.
For any of us, I reckon.
Well, it's funny. We started the show with you saying you feel like that you and Dave Anthony are on level footing. And now with that with that rant on American politics, I feel like you have assumed Dave's mantle quite willingly. Well done, Osh. Thank you for joining me on Faux Pop. I'd love to have you back on at some point. What can people find you on, listen to, watch at the moment?
Oh, I just hook into Better Than Yesterday. It's a podcast that I've been doing since 2013. Get on board with that. Bachelorette is about to start, the world's first Indigenous bisexual Bachelorette. And of all the TV I've ever made, it's probably the series I'm most proud of because it's fucking cool. It's really good. And I don't know, are we going to do another season of Dad Pod?
I guess so.
Want to
well,
do another season of Dad
yeah,
Pod?
Yeah, sure. Once, I mean, I'm not sure if you can hear that, but I got the baby monitor on and Iona is freaking the hell out.
Toronto! I've got a baby monitor on too.
You feel good!
It sounds like Paul Stanley's waking up.
You know, we may be under clear blue skies, but you know, it's getting a little cool out tonight, but that ain't gonna stop us, because if we try hard enough, we're gonna get this place!
Harder than hell!
I said we're gonna get this place!
Harder than hell! All right! Yeah!
All right, I'm gonna go get Paul Stanley, gonna feed him some cold gin.
See ya, Osh.